All right, Erev Tov. I don't think Dr. Rivka Schwartz needs an introduction, but we'll welcome her anyways, and we'll slightly introduce her, really thank her for coming back for again for teaching for Torah Motion. She is the assistant principal at SAR in Riverdale, has a PhD from in the history of science from Princeton University, and is really speaks throughout as one of the thinkers and teachers in our community. I would say even especially in the modern Orthodox community, I think very often provocative ideas, if I can use that word in a positive sense, and thoughtful ideas. So we look forward to another shiur on something that will give us lots to think about. Dr. Rivka, bevakasha.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. So I begin this with a story, not yet about this week's parsha, but I promise you that we will get there. Among the other things that I teach in SAR High School, one of the things that I teach is a 10th grade curriculum about sexuality and Jewish sexual ethics that we call Beit Midrash. And the Beit Midrash curriculum is taught in separate gender classes. So I teach some of the girls, and girls and boys are separate and taught by teachers of the same gender. And we look at Jewish sources around both halacha when it comes to sexuality, as well as Torah values when it comes to sexuality. And one of the messages that I give my students consistently and all the time, because I want them to remember it, and the best way I have them to remember it is to repeat it endlessly, is that I say our ideal for you is that ultimately your sexual relationships that you will enter into will be three things. They will be safe, they will be ethical, and they will be halachic. But just because they can't be one of those things doesn't mean they shouldn't be the other two. If you are, in fact, entering into a relationship that is not governed by halacha, it should still be ethical and safe. I say this to my students all the time, not shy about it. I'm so not shy about it that a number of years ago, I wrote an article in one of the Anglo-Jewish newspapers talking about this approach to teaching kids about Jewish sexual ethics, which is to say, to be very clear with them about what the halacha demands of them. To make very clear, we understand that they understand what the demands of halacha are, and also to acknowledge the reality that not all modern Orthodox young adults and adults are going to be fully observant of all those halachot, and that if they are not, there are still ethical precepts that they can learn from Judaism and from other places that can guide how they conduct themselves in these relationships, and that if these relationships that they enter into one day are not halachic, they should nevertheless still be ethical. So I wrote this article and one printed in one of the American Jewish newspapers. And then I was reached out to by a high school teacher of mine. I went to a high school in a more or less Beis Yaakov high school in Brooklyn. And this teacher was herself considerably to the right of where the high school's population was. She's deep in the American yeshivish Haredi world. And she and I had not been in ongoing contact since I left high school. And this was years, indeed decades later. And she reached out to me. She sent me an email. And her email expressed astonishment at the idea that there could be ethics outside of halacha. If people were not acting ethically, they could, if they were not acting halachically, I'm sorry, they could not possibly be acting ethically. Because halacha is the determinant and the definer of that which is ethical. So she sent me this email very taken aback that I could even say this. And I responded to her and I said, I understand that's your position. I know that is your position. That is a position. But I don't hold that position. So however astonishedly you express yourself, that doesn't change the fact that you don't think there can be any ethic outside of halacha. And I do. And that's why I am no longer in the world that you are in, if I ever was, or I'm no longer adjacent to the world you are in. And I'm in the modern Orthodox world that identifies modern Orthodox. And so your astonishment is not a reflection of anything other than the fact that there are indeed two very different positions here that we hold, and we hold them very differently. And therefore, the vigor with which you express your position is not going to change the fact that there really is a significant difference here. The classical place for exploring the conflict between halacha and ethics, the question of whether there is or can be an ethics outside of halacha. Does halacha determine what is ethical, or are there other ways to think about what's ethical? And if there are, what do we do when the halacha tells us to do something that goes against our ethical sense? The classic place to think about that is in the commandments surrounding the eradication of Amalek and the seven nations when the Jews enter the land of Israel, and we are enjoined to completely eradicate a number of different nations for different reasons, the seven nations inhabiting the land and the nation of Amalek. And our first encounter with Amalek happens in this week's Parsha. At the end of Parsha B'Shalach, that's where Amalek shows up at the party for the first time. The Jews are exiting Egypt, have just exited Egypt, and they're kind of starting to make their way through the desert, and they are set upon by this nation that attacks the weak and the stragglers. And we know in this Parsha, we have the famous story of the battle, and Moshe being helped to hold his hands up, and as long as his hands are up, they prevail in the battle, and his hands fall down, they falter in the battle. And the Parsha ends off with some kind of exhortation that we have to continue this battle against Amalek because God has an eternal war, an eternal battle against Amalek. For years, I taught this topic and I taught these questions in Machshava Yisrael, in a Jewish philosophy course that SAR High School offers, that's actually a required course for all 11th graders. And I would say to them, we aren't actually kept up at night by questions of Amalek. This seems very distant. It seems very not relevant to the world we live in. For most of my students, the actual place where this question comes up, the conflict between ethics and halakha, where they actually feel it in their lives, is in halakha as it regards LGBTQ people, gay people, trans people, queer people. The fact that Orthodox understanding of halakha, however an accepting or welcoming interpretation or spin one puts on it, is still not going to treat gay people and gay relationships, or, you know, as the equal of, or as celebrated as, or as halakhically uncomplicated as straight people and straight relationships. That's just that is just the halakhic reality of where Orthodox Judaism is. And for many of my students, that is an ethical challenge that is very difficult for them to surmount. And so I would say, okay, we're going to talk about Amalek, but I understand you don't really care about Amalek. We're just using Amalek as a stand-in, or the issues you really do care about, or if not LGBTQ issues, which actually I care more about. There are women's issues. Side note, it is unceasingly fascinating to me that the disparate treatment of LGBTQ Jews within Orthodoxy is far more disturbing to my students than the disparate treatment of women within Orthodoxy, despite the fact that women are half of the Jewish population and LGBTQ Jews, whatever percentage they are, it's significantly less than half. But nevertheless, the issue of women and the status of women within Orthodoxy seems to bother my contemporary American students less than the status of LGBTQ people within Orthodoxy. I just leave that out there as an interesting observation and question. So that was the case for the years I taught Machshava Yisrael, and for many years that Amalek was a kind of model case for something that we didn't actually care about, but it would help us talk about the things we do care about. And here we are in January of 2024, and the questions of Amalek and what we mean when we talk about Amalek and how we understand the commandments to destroy Amalek and how we understand even these verses and these texts is newly a live topic of conversation and discussion. You will all know that when he was announcing the ground invasion into Gaza, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu referenced the psukim, Zachorit Asher Asal Lecha Amalek, the verses that enjoin us to remember what Amalek did to us, as a way of announcing the ground invasion with reference to this historic enemy that attacked the weak among us, and that attack must always be remembered and the enemy must be destroyed. And that and other exhortations to remember Amalek have been adduced as evidence by those who say the state of Israel is engaged in a genocidal project in Gaza, to say, look, they are invoking a biblical story about a nation that they are commanded to wipe out. And so if they are invoking that story and talking about this war, clearly that tells us what their intentions are in regard to this war. There was a maybe somewhat infamous incident in which the New York Times, an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently, trying to make the case in support of South Africa's genocide claim in the International Court of Justice, referenced some of the psukim about eradicating Amalek, and various people pointed out that those psukim were not the ones that Prime Minister Netanyahu cited or quoted. He was quoting from psukim that appear in Chumash, so that was from psukim that appear in the Navi. Whether one thinks that's relevant or not, or like Amalek is one category, or was dishonest undertaking by the reporter to cite other psukim, maybe, you know, gorier or more murderous psukim to make what Netanyahu said sound worse than what he had said, I'm not interested right now in debating Netanyahu's rhetoric. I'm only saying that this conversation, which I once thought was really a stand-in for the conversations we really wanted to have, has become again a conversation that I don't know if we wanted to have, but maybe we feel more like we need to have. A conversation about what do we do about a Torah commandment that seems to violate our ethical sense. And so there are a number of conversations to have here, starting with the conversation of, is this in fact a live commandment in any meaningful sense? And then moving on to the question of, what do we do with it if it is? And even if it isn't, even if we can come up with, and as I'll tell you shortly, there are plenty of different ways to come up with ways to say this no longer is actually incumbent upon us. And at no point now or in the future is anyone actually going to expect me to pick up a sword to kill all members of the nation of Amalek, men, women, children, infants. That's never going to happen. Even if we say that, we are still left with the question of the Torah commanding us to do something that doesn't sit so easily, probably with very many of us. And understanding how do we think about that, and how do we think about our discomfort and our understanding and how we approach it. And so that's what I wanted to talk about this evening. So let's start with the getting ourselves out of the problem first. The very practical question, is there going to be a day in which we are asked to pick up weapons and actually go about fulfilling the positive commandment of eradicating Amalek? So there are a lot of ways of getting out of this, and already Chazal and the Gemara are taking advantage of the ways of getting out of this. One of the big ones is the assertion that Sanherib, the Assyrian king, came along and mixed up the whole world. That Sanherib, the Assyrian king, engaged in large-scale population transfers. He moved people from here to there and there to here, and therefore we no longer know what nation anyone is part of or where they're from. And so even if someone lives in Amaleki territory and they speak the Amaleki language, we can't necessarily assume they are of Amaleki lineage, because Sanherib mixed the whole world around. And we use that as a way to get us out of all kinds of different commandments and proscriptions that attach to people based on their national origin. Whether it's Amalek or Ammon and Moab that can't come into the Jewish people or anything else, we give ourselves an all-purpose get-out-of-jail-free card. Sanherib mixed up the whole world, and therefore we don't know who's who anymore, and therefore we don't have to follow those. Obviously, one could further talk about whether one thinks that Chazal are really saying to us that Sanherib mixed up the whole world and engaged in large-scale population transfers, or whether Chazal are really saying to us, this is not a set of commandments that we really are interested in trying to figure out how to implement in our world, and so we will take a very useful historical story about Sanherib and his population transfers and let it do its work for us. But even beyond that, when we get into the halachic question, there are all kinds of halachic conversations about to whom and in what way and under what circumstances would the commandment to eradicate Amalek even hypothetically apply, many of which serve to, again, distance us from the possibility that this would ever come to pass. So, for example, the Rambam, in talking about this, says, well, first of all, Amalek, like any other nation, we offer them the chance to make peace if they adopt the seven Noahide commandments, the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, and they live according to those commandments, then even Amalek can be left alone to live in peace. It's only if they refuse our offers for peace and they refuse our offer to live according to mitzvot b'nei Noach that we are then commanded to wage war against them. And even then the Rambam says, this is not an individual commandment. You have to get up and find your neighboring Amaleki and kill them. It is a commandment for the nation as a nation led by the king, all of which is a way to say, it's not happening now, may not be happening ever. Don't have to worry about it. Don't have to think so much about being commanded to eradicate Amalek. But that only serves to satisfy up to a point. It still remains the fact that there is a commandment on the books to eradicate Amalek, and another commandment on the books to remember that you have to eradicate Amalek. And we read this out loud in shul once a year, with the, it's coming up not so soon, but soon enough, right before Purim. In Adar, we read about the commandment to eradicate Amalek. And I don't know about you, that's going to sit differently with me this year than it sat in previous years. I'm like, not in such an easy or comfortable way. I mean, I don't know how easy or comfortable it was any year, but maybe it's easier or comfortabler when it feels like it's some ritual we're enacting, but that's speaking about something that's in the distant past or not relevant or doesn't speak to profound moral and ethical questions we're dealing with now. So it lands differently right now. some other thinkers have attempted to deal with the problem by saying that Amalek is not a people or a nation or a lineage or a genealogy. Amalek is an idea. It's a worldview. It's a philosophy. It's an ideology. And it's this philosophy or ideology or worldview that needs to be eradicated, which is, of course, quite different than eradicating people. And that, too, is a much more comfortable, I think, way to think about this and engage with this. And also, I think there's a limit to how much comfort we can draw. Because at the end of the day, we are still facing a Torah that gives us commandments, that tells us what to do. And so now, how do we think about it? And this leads us back to the question that my high school teacher was raising when she got back in touch with me, when she read my article about how we teach about Torah sexual ethics in Aser High School. Because the question that we are asking is, does the Torah define that which is moral and that which is ethical? The beginning and end, the Alpha and the Omega, if you will, of that which is ethical in the world is that which the Torah commands us to do. If the Torah tells us to do it, it's ethical. If the Torah tells us not to do it, it is not ethical. There is no ethics outside of Torah. And therefore, there is no such thing as a commandment that is unethical. There is only a shortcoming in your own understanding or a lack of your own understanding or ability to properly apprehend the world. If you could properly apprehend the world, you would know that there is no such thing as a commandment that is unethical, even if, like the commandment to kill Amaleki babies, it really, really doesn't sit well with you. The scholars who study this and look at this basically all say that while that is a view that is has become extremely standard in the Haredi world of the 20th and 21st century, the Chazon Ish, among others, articulates this view, that that is very clearly not the view of the majority of Jewish thinkers. The majority of Jewish thinkers through the ages have indeed thought that there were, and going all the way back to Chazal, talking about this in the Gemara, that there were before Matan Torah, they'll use the language of before Matan Torah to talk about ethical systems or moral systems that preexisted the giving of the Torah and therefore that particular set of divine commandments. Or discussions about mitzvot sichliot, rational mitzvot, that even if you weren't commanded, you could figure out on your own, presumably from an ethical sense of yours that derives from sources other than the Torah, because you could figure them out even if you weren't commanded. The most obvious place that we find this is actually in the Torah itself. The most obvious place we find the idea that there is an ethics or morality outside of divine commandment, indeed one against which a divine commandment can be held up and found wanting. There is an ethical yardstick separate from what Hashem says. And I can actually measure kivyachol what Hashem says against that ethical yardstick and say, Hashem, you're not measuring up. That itself is found in the Torah, in Avraham Avinu's confrontation with God about the plan to destroy Sodom. Right? This is not any fancy footwork, any interpretive, hermeneutic, exegetical, anything. It's there in the Psukim in the Torah. So God tells Avraham God's plan, right? About wiping out the people of Sodom because they are terrible and evil sinners. And Abraham says, how could you do that? Ha'af tispet tzadik im rasha. Will you wipe away the innocent along with the guilty? And then he starts to ask, maybe there are 50 righteous people in the city. And then he says this famous pasuk, chalila lecha me'asot kadavar hazeh. Like, God forbid that God would do this. Heaven forbid that you would do this to kill the righteous with the wicked. Chalila lecha, Abraham repeats himself again. Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo ya'aseh mishpat. Will the judge of the entire world not do justice? That question presupposes that there is a measure of justice beyond the divine will. And so it is possible that the judge of the entire world, that God, will do something that is not justice. Abraham indeed is saying, you have proposed to me to do something that is not justice. And I'm asking, what if there are 50 righteous in them, right? We know Avram bargains his way all the way down. There aren't that many righteous people in Sodom, and ultimately God destroys Sodom. And so those sources that say there is, of course, an idea in Jewish philosophy and Jewish thought of an ethics outside of the Torah's commandments, they trace that idea all the way back to the Torah itself. To Avram Avinu saying, Hashafet kol ha'aretz lo ya'aseh mishpat, is it possible that the judge of the entire world will not do justice? Which again suggests that there is some other measure of what justice is independent of what the judge of the entire world is telling Abraham that the judge of the entire world is planning to do. So what now and where does that leave us? What do we do if that ethical sense, whatever it is that exists outside of the Torah's commandments, raises questions for us about the commandments that we have been given in the Torah? How do we think about that and what do we do with that? I want to recount to you here a story, which I would say it's almost certainly apocryphal, but I really don't know. It has a very good chance of being apocryphal, and yet it is very useful for illustrating a kind of break here between more traditional Jews and more progressive Jews and how we think about this question. And the apocryphal story goes thus. I heard it told about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, but honestly, I don't know who it happened with or if it ever happened. Doesn't really matter. We'll tell about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is flying on an airplane with a grandson of his, and he is being very assiduously tended to by the grandson. And the grandson is coming over to him and taking care of his every need and Zayda, can I get you this? And Zayda, do you need this? The entire flight. And at some point during the flight, Rav Yaakov's seatmate or neighbor says to him, I can't believe it. I can't get my grandchildren to give me the time of day. They don't call. They don't write. They don't visit. They're not at all interested in me. And your grandchild is standing here waiting on you hand and foot, taking care of your every need. What's your secret, Rabbi? How do you do it? And the apocryphal rabbi star of this apocryphal narrative says, you believe that human beings evolved from lower species. The story actually goes, you believe human beings evolved from monkeys. But the theory of evolution really doesn't say that human beings evolved from monkeys. So we will spell it not like that. You believe human beings evolved from lower species. So every generation older that you are closer to the lower species. So why should your grandchild respect you? He is more evolved, more advanced, and has progressed farther than you. Whereas we believe that the font of all of knowledge, wisdom, ethics, teaching, everything else was at the revelation at Sinai. And every older generation is a generation closer to the revelation at Sinai. And the farther away from that you get, the more you decline. And so I, being two generations closer than my grandson to the revelation at Sinai, am somebody who is worthy of respect. That story, whether the story happened or not, is actually of no consequence. The story is enormously useful for illustrating a core problem here, which is that any notion of progressing or evolving morality runs us up smack against something that is theologically a profound problem for Orthodox Judaism, which is that if the Torah is the eternal font of all wisdom and the word of God, what exactly does it mean that you have progressed beyond that? All right, that is a very good question. So again, if one is working from a more progressive framework and one is not bound to all of these ideas, then one can indeed say the ideas of, you know, the ancient Near East were what they were, and here we are. We have greater understanding of all these things. We're in a more advanced, more developed, more sophisticated place, and we have a better understanding. But that is not how traditional Judaism views the world. And so there are various more contemporary Jewish thinkers who are trying in one way or another to work that through, to work that out, to square the circle. One of them is Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. He wrote about this topic at another time in recent history when, for somewhat different reasons, the idea of biblical or religious commandments to kill non-combatants, to kill civilians, to kill women and children was salient and troubling. And that was right after 9/11, when the question of people who thought that they had a religious mandate to just strike at civilian populations and kill civilian populations, and how do we think about that? And then how do we think about places where our own texts seem to give us mandates to kill civilian populations? So that was salient in a different way than it is now, but salient all the same. And Dr. Lamb wrote a long essay about evolving halachic morality, the case of the seven nations and Amalek. And here, to boil it down, take however many 40 pages of his essay and make it short. You can easily find it online. It's posted on YU Torah. And read the whole thing if you'd like, but to boil it down, he says the following. It is not okay to replace values of the Torah with modern or contemporary or of the moment values. Torah is eternal and the word of God, and we don't swap the words of Torah out for whatever are the mores of the day. But, says Rabbi Dr. Lamb, there are many values in the Torah. And what one can do is to say that I am going to emphasize a different Torah value that might not once have been emphasized or might not have been emphasized this early or might not have been emphasized this much. And I am instead going to prioritize or emphasize that value. So that, for example, if you look at, say, our turning away from slavery as a practice or a thing to do, you can say, yes, the halacha permits slavery, but there is also a Torah value about every human being created in Tzelem Elokim, the value and worth of every individual. And we now are going to emphasize, promote, uplift, elevate that value of every human being created in Tzelem Elokim, so that even if the law allows us to enslave others, we are no longer going to do that in the service of this value. But it always must be the case that this other value is also a Torah value. And he emphasizes a number of times in this essay, we are not going outside of Torah or Judaism to just pick up the values of the day. It is only if we operate within Torah Judaism, we draw on the values of Torah Judaism, that we can then say, and in the interest of supporting those values, we will no longer do something, even if it's permitted by the law, or maybe even in some cases, set aside something that is required by law. Who am I to say this to Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, but I will say it nevertheless. I find this profoundly unconvincing. And here's why I find it profoundly unconvincing. We can take Torah values of Tzelem Elokim, of Kavod HaBriot, of shaming other people in public, and I can find them to be, if not infinitely elastic, fairly extremely elastic. So that, to give you a very concrete example, in the course of this essay, and clearly Rabbi Dr. Lamb is engaging in some defensive maneuvering in the essay. He doesn't want to be accused of saying the Joker is wild, you can do whatever you want. He wants to be very clear that he is trying to limit or circumscribe. He's essentially trying to give an apologetic in the years after 9/11 for why Jews should not be held accountable for also having a religious teaching that licenses the killing of innocents or the killing of civilians or mass murder. He doesn't want that laid at our doorstep. At the same time, then, in the early 2000s, and I think it's important to say a very different world than the world we live in today, he does not want to be seen as giving license to other activities like the ones I told you that my students or other issue in other areas that are the ones my students are pushing on, where he could be very easily interpreted as giving license. And so here is what he writes. I let you know that some of you may find this troubling or offensive. I'm reading to you from Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb's essay from 2004. These caveats that we cannot go outside of Torah and seek values from elsewhere are especially applicable in the area of sexual mores. For instance, no amount of earnest moralizing can convert homosexual relations, which the Torah considers an abomination, into a form of acceptable alternative morality. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself does not trump the ban on illicit love, whether homosexual or heterosexual or incestuous. So Rabbi Lamb is saying, yes, we can interpret values of the value of human life or Tzelem Elokim or these other things to say that we do not have to take it as far as we can with the commandment to eradicate Amalek. We can allow other values to triumph over some of these earlier statements of Torah values or commandments, but not when they are values that come from the outside. But of course, that question of what comes from the inside and what comes from the outside is profoundly subjective and malleable. So somebody will say, Dr. Lamb, you too are coming from the outside. If God says to kill all of Amalek, you kill all of Amalek. That's somebody to the right of Dr. Lamb will say. And somebody to the left of Dr. Lamb, Rabbi Lamb, will say, it is also a Torah value that can adduce many Torah values that would call for the full embrace of LGBTQ members of our community. And what do you mean that's a value from the outside? I can find values from inside that will militate in favor of it. And so profoundly unconvincing, because at the end of the day, it is an argument that only convinces people who are already convinced by it. If I don't think you're doing the right thing, then I say, well, you've brought the wrong values or using them in the right way. And if I think I'm doing the right thing, I say, well, you see, I've brought the right values and I'm doing it in the right way. It doesn't give us any guidance beyond saying people who are trustworthy to judge and whose judgment can be relied on should be allowed to judge about these things. And so I guess it's a, I appreciate the effort, but I'm not entirely sure where this is getting us. There are a lot of comments coming into the chat. I just want to be perfectly clear that I'm not reading them right now. It is really not possible to sustain a flow of thought while reading lots of comments coming into the chat. So we'll address questions when it's time for questions. But if you're putting things in the chat, that's great. I'll look at them later. I'm not looking at them right now. There are a lot more sources to talk about and not a lot more time. So let's try to move expeditiously. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that's all, wrote a very famous essay back in the 1970s talking about the idea of an ethic outside of halacha. And he takes a somewhat different tack, although, as we would expect from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, it's kind of dense and difficult and slow going and takes a lot of times reading through to get it. I had like a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of this essay that I could barely read. And so I finally went online to try to find the book. The book is called Modern Jewish Ethics. It's published in like 1975 or something. It's a collection of essays, and I wanted my own copy to have a clean copy of Rav Aaron's essay. And I finally found a copy in some used book website, and I got it. It had been remaindered from the theology library of some Catholic University of Theology that I guess decided they didn't need this book of Modern Jewish Ethics that was 25 or 45 whenever I bought it years old. So I have this remaindered copy still stamped like Sacred Heart University or whatever it is that I have of Aaron's essay now. And here's what he says. He says, we use the word halacha in two ways. We talk about halacha and the halacha. When we say the halacha is, we usually mean here is a legal ruling. You may not. Right? The halacha is you can't turn on the light on Shabbos. The halacha is you can't cook milk with me. I'm talking about a law, about a legal ruling, about may not. He says, but halacha as a concept is much bigger than that. This is actually a super fascinating idea that there's no way we're going to have time to fully explore right now, but I just want to certainly put it out there and raise it and introduce it into the conversation. Halacha, not the halacha is, but halacha as a concept, right? Which literally, of course, means the way or something like that, the way we go, is not just about laws and rulings. Within this broader concept of halacha is also something called lifnim mishurat hadin, something beyond that which the law requires. And there are many places where within the context of legal discussions, we talk about going beyond that which the law requires. So in a sense, the law itself, not in this specific ruling or that specific ruling, but contains space within the broader corpus of the law for an idea of going beyond the specific requirement. So here's another famous example. In Chumash Vayikra, Parashat Kedoshim begins with the exhortation, Kedoshim tihiyu, ki kadosh ani, you shall be holy, for I, Hashem, your God, am holy. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, very famously comments there that what that, com so what's the commandment to be holy? That's a great question, right? We have lots of commandments. Don't mix milk and meat. Don't eat pork. Great. Lots of commandments. Keep Shabbos. Honor your parents. Lots of, don't speak Lashon Hara. Lots of commandments. What's the commandment to be holy? And so different people say different things. Rashi also famously says that it means to make a protective fence against sexual immorality, that there are specific prohibitions about sexual immorality, but then there's another commandment to make even more prohibitions in front of the prohibitions to keep you from approaching sexual immorality. Ramban says something else. Ramban says, even in that which is permitted to you, you have to sanctify yourself so that you do not become a naval, a debased person, birshut haTorah, with the Torah's permission. Like I legalistically, everything I'm doing, I'm allowed to do. There's nothing that stops you from halachically, say, from indulging in enormous amounts of, of food and just like I'm eating 14 meals a day and every kind of procuring every kind of exotic and whatever it is. And I'm just obsessed with meeting my physical needs, my physical pleasures all the time. But I haven't done anything wrong. I stop and I break in my endless party for Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv. I'm davening three times a day. It's like all good. But the Ramban refers to that as being a naval birshut haTorah, a kind of debased person with the Torah's permission. And so the commandment to be holy is a commandment even beyond that which the halacha specifically prohibits, a broader sense of what the lifnim mishurat hadin folded into halacha is. And if you think about it that way, then first of all, you maybe subsume the morality outside of halacha into halacha. Because it's no longer outside of halacha exactly. It might be outside of the specific rulings of the law, but halacha covers more than the specific rulings of the law. And then it also stops being outside in the sense, again, it's not the specific rulings, but it is part of the values and the value system that gets incorporated into bigger thing. And so he ends off his essay, which he starts with, you know, is there an ethic outside of halakha? And he says, well, not a Jewish thing to do to just give you a simple answer to that. And then he goes on for many pages. He doesn't give you a simple answer. And then he says, for those who prefer definitive answers, let me conclude by saying, does the tradition recognize an ethic independent of halakha? You define your terms and take your choice. Meaning, depending on how you understand the term halakha, and depending on what you think about the idea of being ethic independent of halakha, you can come up with different answers to that question. This is an attempt to both say that there are values that are not covered by the law, and also to bring them into the embrace of the halakhic system. Those values are not outside of the system. The system itself makes space for more values than the law itself demarcates or contains. That I think is a very powerful idea and one that's worth sitting with. Again, the question of who defines, who says, what are the parameters, what are the limits? People will cite cases, for example, from the Talmud, where the rabbis will say that in the interest or the service of a greater value, they abrogate the law. Even in some noteworthy cases, they abrogate Torah law in the service of some greater value. But then we all hasten to say, but we today cannot do that. We are not of their level of authority, scholarship, knowledge, or anything else. And so that ability to say that we are abrogating the law in service of a greater value, while that once existed as a possibility, does not exist as a possibility now. Which leaves us again asking these questions about what do we do with this sense that values and ethics might conflict with the demands of halakha. There are at least another couple of things I want to touch on. I apologize for whizzing through a little bit quickly, but I will at least try to give you names and citations if you want to explore a little more. There's a contemporary Israeli philosopher named Ronit Yershai, who has written quite a bit about these questions. Specifically, she writes in the realm of both feminist issues and LGBTQ issues, and where halakha conflicts with the law. And in one of her papers, she writes about two approaches, what she calls Akedah theology, and then Tamar Roth's idea of cumulative revelation. And I want to talk about both of those. Akedah theology is this idea connected to the idea that the divine commandment defines the borders of that which is ethical, and all that which is ethical is inside the divine commandment, and nothing that is outside the divine commandment is ethical. And therefore, what Akedah theology demands is that if your ethical sense conflicts with the divine commandment, you are called upon to sacrifice, give up your sense of the ethical, to not do that which you see as ethical, and instead to follow the divine commandment. I said that this comports with the Haredi ideas of the 20th century, that the divine commandment gives us the boundaries of the ethical. It also draws upon the famous ideas of the famous philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, who talks about the Akedah and Avraham, that the heroic thing that he did in that moment is that he suspends the ethical in the face of the divine command, and that is in fact what you are called upon to do. And these ideas, both drawing from works of philosophy, development of Jewish thought, that we get to this idea of Akedah theology, that we sacrifice our own sense of the ethical. And so this argument is that in the face of the conflict, what we are called upon to do is to swallow our ethical qualms and follow the commandment. I'll say a couple of things about this. One is I saw online that Rabbi Gil Student quoted Reb Fivel Cohen, the author of the Ba'adei HaShulchan, who is an American halachist of the latter part of the 20th and early part of the 21st century, was also my shul rabbi growing up, passed away last year. And he quoted Reb Fivel Cohen as saying that he thinks that the mitzvah of eradicating Amalek is going to be the hardest mitzvah to keep, the hardest mitzvah in the Torah, because it so goes against our sense of right and wrong. And the implication, as Rabbi Studen quoted revival, and as certainly my everything I know about revival would suggest, is that revival was saying, and nevertheless, we must keep the commandment because there's a divine commandment given to us by an intelligence and an ethical sense greater than ours. And that comports to a particular understanding of what's going on in Akedah Yitzchak, right? That's why Akedah theology, that when Abraham is commanded to offer up his son as a sacrifice, and he's thinking to himself, what the heck is this God? He nevertheless goes along and offers his son as a sacrifice. Some contemporary thinkers have really tried to challenge that read on the Akedah and to say that's fundamentally a misreading of the Akedah story and of what happens. Most fundamentally, because if you read to the end of the story, an angel shows up and says, don't stretch out your hand against the young man and don't do anything to him. That the ultimate desire is not, in fact, that Abraham sacrifice his child. So Professor Aaron Kohler, who's a professor at Yeshiva University, wrote a whole book called Unbinding Isaac, The Significance of the Akedah for Modern Jewish Thought, to argue against this idea of that what the lesson that we take away from the Akedah is the lesson of suspending our ethical sense in the face of divine command, and to say that the lesson of the Akedah is that there is a much more complicated or nuanced or complex ethical lesson or teaching to take from the Akedah, and it is not simply that when something seems unethical to you, but God tells you to do it, you go ahead and do it. The same Professor Kohler caused more than a bit of a stir. You know, in my mind, I feel like, oh, he just wrote this article. And then I go back and I look it up, and he wrote the article in 2019, because my brain is still working in like before COVID time and after COVID time. And everything that happened since COVID still feels like it's all collapsed into one, I don't know what. And so if it happened before, you know, it feels like it just happened, but it happened in 2019. He wrote a column in The Observer, which is a student newspaper of Stern College for Women, Yeshiva University's Women's College. And he wrote a column in The Observer, obviously connected to the work that he was doing for this book, which he was then writing, in which he said that he does not actually think that the right thing to do here is to sacrifice, because he said sacrificing one's ethical sense is not really sacrificing my own sense of ethics. What I'm really sacrificing is the other people, whether in this case he was talking about being asked about celebrating a gay marriage, or whether it's whoever else that I'm being asked to sacrifice in the name of the divine command that doesn't sit well with me ethically. But I'm saying, well, what can I do as a divine command? And then who I end up sacrificing is not myself. I'm doing something that doesn't feel ethical to me. But who I'm really sacrificing is other members of the community that I'm sacrificing for this. And he says the actual sacrifice that I'm called upon to make here is I say that I'm going to do the thing that seems to me to be doing right by most members of community. And the sacrifice I'm making is that, so to speak, I will take my lumps in the world to come. If I have actually done something against God's will and I have to be punished for it, then I will be punished for it. It's almost give you a whole civil disobedience against God. Right? The idea of civil disobedience. My students sometimes think that civil disobedience just means you break the rules. I have to remind my students that civil disobedience as practiced by the Reverend Martin Luther King and Bayard Rustin and others in the civil rights movement meant that you broke the law and then you took the punishment for breaking the law, right? John Lewis went to prison. You don't just break the law. That's not civil disobedience. You break the law and then you take the punishment. And so Professor Kohler is actually talking about a kind of civil disobedience against God, give you a hope. That if I think the law is not ethical, then the Akedah theology that Yerushai describes, which is you bind your own ethical sense, you give up your own ethical sense, and you just do the divine command, Kohler says, well, that actually means I'm sacrificing somebody else. Not just sacrificing my ethical sense, I'm sacrificing somebody else. I think it's untenable. And what I really have to sacrifice is, so to speak, my own spiritual well-being. I'm agreeing to take the punishment, if there's going to be one, for what I'm doing here, at the price of creating a more welcoming community. I will finally introduce the ideas of Tamar Ross. Tamar Ross is a professor of philosophy in Israel. She wrote a book called Expanding the Palace of Torah. And what she is trying to do is to create a feminist theology. Now, I'm not really usually a super theologically inclined person, although there's a lot of theology in this talk, because once you start to ask if God can get it wrong ethically or morally, you're deep in the realm of theology. And so I'm not going to pretend, I'm going to be very clear that I'm citing that which I've read from Professor Ross and cannot claim to know firsthand. But she draws upon a wide range of Hasidic and Kabbalistic teachings and the teachings of Rav Kook to talk about how, as much as there's this core Jewish idea that I shared with you as encapsulated in that story of Yaakov Kamenetsky, of every generation farther from Sinai, a decline of the generations, the Yiridat HaDorot, that there are some mystical and Kabbalistic Jewish teachings that talk about some way in which there is new Torah or new holiness in the world to be gleaned and gathered in every generation. That is not simply a process of losing that which was given to us and we keep falling away, but actually that there is some process of gain and accretion and adding on. And she wants to argue that some of these new ways of thinking about the world that derive from the progression of modern morality and ways of thinking, feminism, broader inclusion within the community, that we can view those as, again, a process that she calls cumulative revelation of God revealing God's self to us in every generation, sharing some more with us that we are now prepared to see, to hear, to take in, to incorporate, and that that actually can be seen not as a challenge to the divine command. It's not like, oh, the divine command was wrong or God got things wrong, but there is still more for us to learn and do and bring in. As a matter of how to run a Jewish community, this is obviously enormous appeal, right? It lets us say that instead of finding ourselves in the Amalek predicament, I'm commanded to do it. It seems really wrong to me, but I'm commanded to do it. Again, or in our contemporary equivalent, whether it comes to women or LGBTQ issues or whatever it is, instead of finding ourselves saying, as I say, I'm an Orthodox Jew, right? My own preferences might be whatever they are, but the halakha binds me. I am bound by halakha. This would create a place to say there is somehow a way out of that. And so it is very appealing as a way to run a community. I have to say that as theology, I have a very difficult time with it. Again, Professor Ross knows far more than I do about Kabbalah, about Hasidut, about the teachings of Rav Kook, about everything else. But it is ultimately pretty non-normative Jewish theology to start talking about some kind of cumulative or progressive revelation. And obviously, considering that one of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith is we got the Torah we got, and that is all there is, finished, full stop. And that becomes really important historically once other religions come along and say, well, there was that revelation and then there was another one, or that there was that revelation, another one, and one more after that. Then us holding the line on there was only that revelation once, full stop, becomes very important. Again, Professor Ross is a sophisticated and deep thinker. If you want to see more about the ways in which she distinguishes this idea of cumulative revelation from the obvious challenges about, you know, what about the New Testament, the Quran, our book is called Expanding the Palace of Torah, because that's what it's about. And there is a great deal to think about, engage with there, but ultimately I find it as a theological argument, as a way to think about God, Torah, Jewish people in the world. I find it less than persuasive. If you end up here and you say, okay, Rivka, I heard you say a lot of things. I quote a lot of thinkers. I'm bringing a lot of ideas, but I did not hear how you solved this problem. I will say to you, bingo. I have not. This problem I'm not even sure problem is the right word. This is the core issue that I confront as a modern Orthodox Jew in the world. I'm an Orthodox Jew. I daven in a shul, the mechitza. One of the teachers, we daven mincha. I'll tell you another SAR story that happened today. We daven mincha in school. We have minyanim, right? It's a co-ed school, boys and girls. So we have minyanim. We daven with a minyan. But unlike shacharit, which we daven together in pretty large spaces, we have more than 100 kids davening together. Mincha, it's the middle of the day. We're all scattered here and there. We bring two or three classes together in a room and daven in a room. So I might only have in a room 20 boys and 20 girls. That's who's maybe even fewer, 17 boys and 17 girls, davening mincha in a room. So you could very rapidly see what starts to happen. If the boys are straggly about getting into mincha, we can find ourselves without a minyan. And it happens like all the time, multiple times a week. But I have seven boys there and I'm waiting for a minyan to materialize. And not only do I have three girls there, I might have 10 girls there. And we cannot start are halakhically, orthodoxly constituted minyan until I have my 10 freshman high school boys, or, you know, 8 freshman high school boys and 2 teachers in the room, even though I have 3 adult women teachers and 10 high school girls, all of whom are halakhically above the age of majority. And so one of the teachers who's in the room with us taking attendance, who's not an Orthodox Jew, said to me today, can I just ask, it's fine, it's just, let me, could a girl lead mincha? Can we just get started with a girl davening? And I had to say to him, yeah, no, don't do that. Girl can't lead mincha. Right. So it's a little funny. I'm the senior person in terms of like hierarchy of the school and the room. I'm also a woman. I'm also telling him I don't count for the minyan and I can't leave mincha. We're all waiting for the 14-year-old boys to show up who do count for the minyan and who can leave mincha. So this is the core. This is the core question of what it means to be an Orthodox Jewish person in the world today. And yet, I actually think that I am bound by a halachic system that derives from a Torah given by commanding God. And I don't think I have the option to say, well, our understanding is more advanced or more progressive today, so we're gonna wipe the slate clean and start again in a way that's more congenial to me, even though there might be other ways it'd be more congenial to me, if we're being perfectly honest. And while I was at it, by wiping the slate clean, I get away from the commandment to eradicate Amalek as well. And I think some of these are things we just live with, we just sort of roll with, or we treat as individual issues. What are we going to do about gay people in Orthodoxy as an individual issue? And there's a fundamental question here, which is what do we do when our ethical sense, which is profoundly shaped by the contemporary Western world, doesn't line up with the dictates of halacha or with the commandments of the Torah? And those are questions that there's a great deal of thought and scholarship and study about if we choose to face it and think about them. And for a very long time, I encountered that thought and scholarship and study through the story of Amalek, but I viewed the story of Amalek as tangential to the project. It was just the way in to a conversation that was really about other things that I actually was more invested in or cared more about. And at a time right now, and I want to say both reasons of Hasbara and reasons of principle, I don't want to make it sound like it's just about Hasbara. It's not. It's not just about the world is going to say that Israel's doing a genocide and they talk about Amalek. How do we think about Amalek? It's also because of reasons of what do we think about the idea of a commandment to kill and eradicate civilians and all of them? What do we think about a world in which this is a live question in front of us and forces us, I hope, to confront very uneasily the ethics of that? And not just to sort of shrug it off and say, I don't know, like that's just what it is. So just what it is. And so we find now that this parsha and this story and the questions that it raises are very present and immediate for us in a way they may not always have been, in a way that maybe gets us to face things that really have always been here and continue to be here. They didn't come out of no place and they aren't going away. But in the moment that we are in now where they are on the table in a new or maybe different way, it asks us again to face some questions that have been here and obviously have been very present. Again, there are queer people within Orthodoxy, there are women within Orthodoxy, there are lots of people whose status within Orthodoxy. We could sit here all day long and list people whose status within Orthodoxy is not fully enfranchised, for whom these may have been who these are live questions all along. But the present moment puts the particular case of Amalek in front of us in a more immediate sort of way, and maybe opens up avenues into revisiting and rethinking about some of these questions.
Thank you. Okay, I have a lot to say, but I won't say it now. But if you want to go through the questions, but like I said at the beginning, I'll make you think lots of food for thought. Thank you very much. Dr. Rivka, you'll go through the questions on the chat, and then we can take some more questions, perhaps.
Yeah, we're starting with I know the Hakimi, moving right along. So I'll start with this. A number of things here are interesting comments, but I'm not sure that there's much to say. Somebody raised the question of vegetarianism, being told that if you want to be a vegetarian for reasons of personal preference or whatever, that was fine. But if you were coming at being a vegetarian from an ethics or morality outside of Torah, I think it's wrong to eat animals. That was said not to be fine. That is indeed an idea that I have encountered for exactly the same reason. If God says it's okay to eat meat, how can you say it's not okay to eat meat? It's interesting to raise Rav Kook in this conversation, since Rav Kook was famously a vegetarian except on Yom Tov when he ate meat, apparently. I think I have that right. So that question of like combining the halachic with the ethical. If Abraham were questioning God, he would have protested the Akedah. I think it is more logical to state that he was trying to understand God's ways. So I'll say, first of all, that is a very famous question also. Why does Abraham protest the killing of the people of Sodom and not the killing of his own son. And how do we think about and understand that? And that's a lot of the discussion about what's going on in the Akedah. I would just say that from the Psukim, where Avraham challenges God about turning over stone, it's very hard to read them as a could God explain to me what God's up to? It reads much more like Chalila Lecha said twice, which is like, again, like heaven forbid, how could you do a thing like this? Which seems to be like you're not Tispat Tzadikim Rasha. Will you kill the righteous with the wicked? Really seems like a challenge to the morality of what God's doing. I think that's the simple meaning of the words. Eliezer Berkowitz, yes, it's also worth saying, whole other conversation that we're not going to have now, about Yishayahu Leibovich, who says there is no ethics or morality or anything to halakha. It is simply a set of divine commands, and we keep them because they are divine commands. And if we are keeping them because they satisfy our sense of ethics or morality, then we're actually doing it for us, not for God. And what makes it a thing we do for God is that it's simply because of divine command. Right, so if Torah's truth eternal comes from God, happened to be your morality superior to it. So first of all, Ryan Lichtenstein is not talking about a morality superior to it, but a morality that's outside of it. And again, there are many, many sources to suggest that there is, in fact, a morality that exists. The particular idea that's being introduced here is the idea that Torah defines the boundaries of morality. There is no definition of morality outside of Torah. That's what my high school teacher was saying to me when she said, how can a sexual relationship be ethical if it's not halakhic? I don't have any hard time understanding how a sexual relationship can be ethical if it's not halakha. Two people can be in a relationship not sanctioned by halakha. They aren't married to each other. And there is communication and there is consent and there is honesty and there is trust and there is love and maybe there's even commitment. And they are not halakhically married to each other. And that is a relationship that is not halakhic. And as far as I can see it, it's perfectly ethical. And my high school teacher would not agree. Because it is not halakhic, it is not ethical. So that's not to argue that there's a morality superior to halakha. That's just to argue there's a morality outside of halakha. And now I see links to the articles. Okay, great. So Greg Berman has his hand up. Can you unmute yourself?
Hi, Dr. Shoshelli. Thank you for the lecture. It was very interesting, and I really like your presentation. Although I do have a fundamental problem that I think you assume that whatever you call ethics exists on sort of an objective plane. And what you try to do is to make sure that halakhic ethic actually conforms to what you deem to be an objective ethic, which tends to be our modern sensibilities that are formed in the beginning of the 21st century and perhaps 30 years ago. Those ethics would be completely different, and that's how you can see Rabbi Lam's article being something different. Can I just turn this into a question? I would want to understand why wouldn't you want to look, even just using your example of Amalek, of the laws of Amalek, you look at the evolution of the view of that under Halacha, and I think you would actually end up with somewhat more consistent with the modern ethics than if you just look at the Torah commandment, for example. And this question has, there's a question at the end, and there's it's a two-part question. The Chazal does look at the mitzvah of Amalek and considers it binding, but what they do find a problem with is that we still have this ethnic boundaries that existed at the time of the Torah. So what the Chazal actually does is they leave the mitzvah intact, but they change who it applies to, because they say that since this ethnic identity type of definitions of different nations no longer apply, we don't know who Amalek is. So maybe if we did know certainly that who Amalek is, that the mitzvah would apply. But what it does, I think, makes us challenge is should we?
Can I just ask you if you were here from the beginning? Because I talked about this in the beginning.
I did join on my wife's phone, so I didn't.
I talked specifically about this and about Chazal addressing that issue through some kind
sure.
of mixing
so,
up the
so
world.
The way I want to ask that question is the part where I think the laws of Amalek challenge our modern ethics is that Chazal explicitly erases this ethnic divisions between different nations, and I think the more practical use of the Amalek clause is to ask, are the racial preferences we have nowadays, are they halachically ethical? So, for example, what is the basis under which we could say that one ethnicity could be preferred to another ethnicity? How we could justify halachically affirmative action, for example, where you can give financial benefits to people based on their ethnicity?
Why don't you let Dr. Rifkin answer? We can get to other questions. I just want to, you know, just to be fair to everybody.
At the end, my question is, why won't you try to understand the Chazal on its own terms and have that challenge your modern sensibilities, supposed to use your modern sensibilities to challenge Chazal?
I do not think that reading the commandments of Amalek as being about affirmative action is understanding Chazal on its own terms. I do think that the earlier question that you raised, about seeing these contemporary values as like the right ones or the true ones is the right question. And I want to be very clear that I don't see it that way. I see it as the values we hold. And I think that's why I kept saying it's conflicting with our sense of ethics. I am by training a historian, and I understand perfectly well, as I think we all should, that things that are self-evidently ethically right or wrong today were not self-evidently ethically right or wrong 50 years ago and won't be self-evidently ethically right or wrong 50 years from now. That is very clear. This is not about there was a one true ethics. We just only gradually learned about it. And in 2024, we got right here. We weren't there in 2023, but right now we're here. It is, of course, true that human societies are structured differently and understand things differently, right? Is polygamy ethical or unethical? So you went through a point where it was fine. Then you went through a point where it was like absolutely not fine, super not cool. And we are way evolved. And now we only practice monogamy. And now, you know, at the cutting edge of things, or not even so cutting edge of things, you have people practicing all kinds of polyamory and plural marriages and open relationships. And I don't know, we're kind of back to some earlier construct. So clearly all of these moral constructs are defined by people in time and space. I absolutely do not think that they are some kind of there is this school of thought that looks at natural law. That's a whole other conversation. I'm not going to get into it right now. I readily acknowledge, I think we all have to acknowledge that our senses of morality are shaped by the world and culture and context and time that we're in. Is it moral to have a hereditary king based on the, you know, who his father was? That's going to really depend on not just what time you live in, but even what place in the world you live in right now. Americans think that's a vaguely goofy thing to do. I hear tell that some people in other parts of the world have different views of that. So I readily acknowledge that. And having said that, it doesn't make the question any less pressing. If I experience a conflict between halacha and my ethics, that is something I experience as a conflict, even as I know that my ethics are the product of my particular time, place, and cultural context. Are there any other questions, Rabbi Kelman, that people wanted to get in with?
I don't know if they can raise. I'm going to throw out something. Really, this is a whole new field, just to put in thought a whole other, you know, whole other share. The halachic system that we have today was basically ended in the sixth century. In other words, we cannot argue on Talmudic law. And the halacha, therefore, just really, you know, the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch are really interpreting what it says in the Gemara. Yes, so sometimes you have poskim who give innovative in interpretation. But so you're dealing with a quote-unquote a morality from 1,500 years ago. I think once we have a Sanhedrin again, I think some of these laws might be revisited in ways. In other words, the Torah will develop. The Torah develops. I mean, I'm coming from the modern Orthodox world too. The Torah develops. And therefore, I think some of these problems are, you're right, they may be against our morality, but, it's part of the tragedy, really, that the halacha is not allowed to flow and to be as innovative and progressive, whatever words you want to use, because we no longer have the ability to make takanot and gzeirot and reinterpreting and undo some of the previous things that the chachamim say. So I don't know if you want to have, I mean, that's a big can of worms, but I don't know if you have any comment on that.
I mean, I think there's been more evolution, growth, and change in halacha over the 1,500 years since then to say it was, I mean, just to pick the example of polygamy, which I spoke about as a takana that postdates the time that you're talking about. And certainly there have been other, and it is of course true that the the framework that says we cannot challenge those who came before it. You need a Beit Din that's greater than the one before it. We don't have a Sanhedrin. We can't, keeps us in certain ways locked in, so that when you find, again, Talmud, we talked about this way earlier in the evening, Talmudic enactments that even overturn biblical law for to fulfill some greater ethical purpose, and you say, well, why can't we do that? The answer is, well, you can't do that today, which, you know, I could try to explain to my 16-year-old students. It's not super satisfying to them. And also, I think that holding out there's going to be some great day in the future when we're going to have a new Sanhedrin that's going to solve all our problems in one fell swoop. Some of these things are biblical law, and I don't know where we think, again, if one is committed to the traditional Orthodox understanding that the Torah is the word of God, it's the eternal, inerrant, everything else, word of God, then you're going to have a very hard time making that go away. Again, I suppose you could say the same way that sometimes other biblical laws were, we found a way around them, maybe in a couple of other places too. I mean, I guess perhaps, but I think holding that out as the solution raises some other challenges, not least of which is it perhaps sets expectations.
Yeah, I'm not saying it solves everything, but we do have pretty amazing prayer. And while, you know, the rabbis have the power, the sages, the aphorisms in the Torah, while the Babylonian Talmud says that's only in a passive case, like don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, the Yerushalmi says that's even actively, that the Chachamim have the right to annul the Torah. That's very radical. That's what we call reform today. But that's what the Talmud says. So I agree with you. Of course it doesn't. But I think we have to keep that in mind, that certain halachot, I mean, I don't want to open up another can of worms. You know, woman aliyot is sort of a simpler can of worms, but it's a big can of worms. And, you know, what's quoted Tzibur, and that can that change? And, you know, the resistance is because that's the way the halacha was developed. And for 1500 years, it was like that. But does that mean that's the way the halacha has to be? I don't know that at all. So, you know, I think a lot of the women's issues are reflecting the times of the Talmud from, you know, 1500 years ago, that we have different views than the Talmud has. And I'm glad that I admit it. And I think, you know, a lot of us, people are afraid to admit it, that there's certain halakhot that quote unquote bother us, but you're right. As committed Orthodox Jews, we do them. We try to do them anyway, but okay.
I have a question, Rabbi Kalman.
Ask Dr. Schwartz. Don't ask me.
Comment and one of the questions. I was a bit surprised that the whole question of Kavanot didn't come up tonight, because that seems to me to be the very essence of what we were discussing.
It's a great question. I didn't talk about it because I spoke about Korbanot for Parshat Vayikra. It's a Torah in motion online. So I wasn't, for those people who heard me in Vayikra, I didn't want to do a reprise. That's why I didn't talk about Korbanot.
My other question is, one about speculation. If you go back to, let's say, the pre-Enlightenment era, how much of rabbinic, or how much of pushing was, do you think, was motivated by the fact of rabbis being troubled by what they saw in their own time? I don't know if I made that question that I don't know if I made that question very clear. But what I'm getting is that it seems to me Enlightenment, we've had another set about what we found attractive. And before the Enlightenment, we didn't really have that. So what I'm asking, do you think that rabbis before the Enlightenment were troubled by what they found in the Torah and in the Talmud?
I think it's very clear that there were earlier times in Jewish history when Jews were drawn by the values and the thinking of the world around them. Certainly, right, in the Hellenistic period, we have lots of Jews who are profoundly attracted by the thought and values. I think at that point, you're not talking about rabbinic Judaism in the same way that we're talking about it. So it's not necessarily a question for the rabbis if they did this or did that. But we did not, with the Enlightenment, invent the idea of Jews being powerfully drawn to the values and culture and learning and practices of the world around them, and then figuring out how it did or did not align or mesh or fit. And I actually think that it's interesting. You can make, there's a lot of debate about this, and I'm by no means an expert, you know, in Second Temple Judaism, so I'm not going to wade into that. But the question of how do you think about the levels of sort of holding the line against Greek culture and the levels of accommodation to Greek culture. Obviously, the rabbinic narrative about itself is we held the line against the Hellenizers and we, you know, purified the temple, right? We all know that whole story. But there are also many, many cases, and not just in Greek words, but many cases of influence, of concepts, of ideas, of practices, of all kinds of things coming into the world of Judaism from the world of the Greeks. And again, I'm not enough of a scholar of that to talk about that. And also there's a difference between what the historians think and what our own popular narratives or ourselves are. But this is not the first time in Jewish history that we found ourselves drawn to values, ideas, practices that come from the outside, and then trying to figure out how to put those together with or fit those with more traditional Jewish sources or values. Dalia Hakimi, you had your hand up.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out the fact that no one ever took ayin tachat ayin, you know, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and chain tachat chain, literally. And from the very, very beginning, I had rabbis who argued that destroying Amalek totally, including the children and everybody else, was also never taken literally, and that killing the seven nations was not taken literally in the same way. And that I've even heard it argued by an Orthodox rabbi that homosexuality is not taken literally. It's more about one man raping another man, taking him against his will, pedophilia, that's how that should be interpreted. And I'm just using the ayin tachat ayin as a perfect example that not everything the way it's written has to be taken literally. Because we never, ever, as a nation, destroyed all the seven nations. All these
right. So again, this we talked about this earlier about the varying ways you can interpret it. Part of the problem here is that we can't, that there are things that make us feel good or feel comfortable, but that don't necessarily work. And we have to be careful that we're using things that work. So with something like ayin tachat ayin, when the rabbinic tradition says we don't take it literally, that's very different than the rabbinic tradition saying this is part of Torah we do take literally, until in the 21st century we'd say, oh no, not anymore. And so that's, I think, part of the reason why Rabbi Steven Greenberg and other people's attempts to recast the psukim that prohibit male homosexual sex as not really being what they seem like they are, why those attempts have not met with, you know, broad, warm reception across the Orthodox world, among other things, is the fact that you're showing up now to try to do something that hasn't been done, that doesn't have a history of being the way we interpret the verse, as opposed to ayin and tachat ayin, where it is a history of the way we interpret the verse. With the mitzvah of eradicating Amalek, I talked earlier on about a range of different approaches, but nevertheless, it seems very clear that the idea that there is some level of some commandment to do some amount of some actual going to war and actual killing is taken very seriously, not least in the fact that we have a commandment, we have a separate commandment to remember what they did and to remember the commandment to eradicate them, and reading it out loud in shul. So again, yes to the Rambam saying, well, first we make peace with them and they have the chance to to keep the mitzvah b'nei noach, and it's not your individual commandment anyway, it's a national commandment, and it's an ideology, and it's an this and it's that. But it does seem like at some level we engage seriously with the idea of going to war with people and killing them, not least of all because Shaul gets into big trouble because he didn't kill all of them in the Navi. So that idea is very present and very there.
Okay. We'll let you go. I want to thank you. You know, I don't want to keep you here all night, but thank you very much. By the way, Dr. Aaron Kohler will be giving the first year in 2 weeks. Next week.
Terrific.
Yeah. He's spoken for us a few times also in the past, yes. And gave a whole series on Esther, Megillat Esther, a couple of years ago. But next week, Moshe Shulman, who is giving this series now on Kohelet, will be speaking. I'll have my shirts more on the Siddur. We're up to the third paragraph of the Shema, finally. Tzitzis by Yomer. And if I may, I'm going to end with a cute story you may have heard. You don't have to stay. But I heard, you know, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, they tell the story that if they were on a desert island, this is the way I heard the story from, you know, Eitan, and there was a non-Jew on Shabbos who is dying. So we know the halacha is, in theory, that you're only allowed to save the life of a Jew on Shabbos. We've done away with that, too, through whatever. But that is the theoretical halacha. And it's only because maybe a pogrom, you know, you're allowed to save his life. But if you're on a desert island that nobody know, so they asked him what they would do. So the way I heard the story is Rav Lichtenstein said he would save his life and do tshuva. Because, you know, and Rav Amital said he would save his life and not do tshuva. And I think that encapsulate, I think, a lot of what we were talking about tonight. What do you do when there's sort of a conflict between that? So take your pick, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital. But anyways, thank you, Dr. Rivka. Always a pleasure. We look forward to learning with you in the future. And everybody, Laila Tov, and we should hear good news and good things. And hope to see you soon at another Torah in Motion learning. And please invite your friends to join us. And be well, everybody. Laila Tov and Shabbat Shalom. Bye-bye.
Good night, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.